The chaplain worried about Dunbar, and brooded more over Yossarian now that Orr was gone. To the chaplain, who lived by himself in a spacious tent whose pointy top sealed him in gloomy solitude each night like the cap of a tomb, it seemed incredible that Yossarian really preferred living alone and wanted no roommates. As a lead bombardier again, Yossarian had McWatt for a pilot, and that was one consolation, although he was still so utterly undefended. There was no way to fight back. He could not even see McWatt and the co-pilot from his post in the nose. All he could ever see was Arfi, with whose fustian moon-faced ineptitude he had finally lost all patience, and there were minutes of agonizing fury and frustration in the sky when he hungered to be demoted again to a wing plane with a loaded machine gun in the compartment, instead of the precision bomb sight that he really had no need for. A powerful, heavy 50-caliber machine gun he could seize vengefully in both hands and turn loose savagely against all the demons tyrannizing him, at the smoky black puffs of the flak itself, at the German anti-aircraft gunners below, whom he could not even see, and could not possibly harm with his machine gun, even if he ever did take the time to open fire, at Havermeyer and Appleby in the lead plane for their fearless straight and level bomb run on the third mission to Bologna, where the flak from 224 cannons had knocked out one of Orr's engines for the very last time, and sent him down, ditching into the sea between Genoa and La Spezia, just before the brief thunderstorm broke. Actually, there was not much he could do with that powerful machine gun, except load it and test fire a few rounds. It was no more use to him than the bomb sight. He could really cut loose with it against attacking German fighters, but there were no German fighters anymore, and he could not even swing it all the way around into the helpless faces of pilots like Hoople and Dobbs and order them back down carefully to the ground, as he had once ordered Kid Sampson back down, which is exactly what he did want to do to Dobbs and Hoople on the hideous first mission to Avignon, the moment he realized the fantastic pickle he was in, the moment he found himself aloft in a wing plane with Dobbs and Hoople in the flight headed by Havermeyer and Appleby. Dobbs and Hoople? Hoople and Dobbs? Who were they? What preposterous madness to float in thin air 2 miles high on an inch or two of metal, sustained from death by the meager skill and intelligence of two vapid strangers, a beardless kid named Hoople and a nervous nut like Dobbs, who really did go nuts right there in the plane, running amok over the target without leaving his co-pilot seat and grabbing the controls from Hoople to plunge them all down into that chilling dive that tore Yossarian's headset loose and brought them right back inside the dense flak from which they had almost escaped. The next thing he knew, another stranger, a radio gunner named Snowden, was dying in back. It was impossible to be positive that Dobbs had killed him, for when Yossarian plugged his headset back in, Dobbs was already on the intercom pleading for someone to go up front and help the bombardier. And almost immediately Snowden broke in, whimpering, "Help me. Please help me. I'm cold. I'm cold." And Yossarian crawled slowly out of the nose and up on top of the bomb bay and wriggled back into the rear section of the plane, passing the first aid kit on the way that he had to return for to treat Snowden for the wrong wound, the yawning, raw, melon-shaped hole as big as a football in the outside of his thigh, the unsevered, blood-soaked muscle fibers inside pulsating weirdly like blind things with lives of their own, the oval, naked wound that was almost a foot long and made Yossarian moan in shock and sympathy the instant he spied it, and nearly made him vomit. And the small, slight tail gunner was lying on the floor beside Snowden in a dead faint, his face as white as a handkerchief, so that Yossarian sprang forward with revulsion to help him first. Yes, in the long run he was much safer flying with McWatt. And he was not even safe with McWatt, who loved flying too much, and went buzzing boldly inches off the ground with Yossarian in the nose on the way back from the training flight to break in the new bombardier and the whole replacement crew Colonel Cathcart had obtained after Orr was lost. The practice bomb range was on the other side of Pianosa, and flying back, McWatt edged the belly of the lazing, slow-cruising plane just over the crest of mountains in the middle, and then, instead of maintaining altitude, jolted both engines open all the way, lurched up on one side, and to Yossarian's astonishment, began following the falling land down as fast as the plane would go, wagging his wings gaily and skimming with a massive, grinding, hammering roar over each rocky rise and dip of the rolling terrain like a dizzy gull over wild brown waves. Yossarian was petrified. The new bombardier beside him sat demurely with a bewitched grin and kept whistling, "Whee!" And Yossarian wanted to reach out and crush his idiotic face with one hand as he flinched and flung himself away from the boulders and hillocks and lashing branches of trees that loomed up above him out in front and rushed past just underneath in a sinking, streaking blur. No one had a right to take such frightful risks with his life.
"Go up! Go up! Go up!"
he shouted frantically at McWatt, hating him venomously. But McWatt was singing buoyantly over the intercom and probably couldn't hear. Yossarian, blazing with rage and almost sobbing for revenge, hurled himself down into the crawlway and fought his way through against the dragging weight of gravity and inertia until he arrived at the main section and pulled himself up to the flight deck to stand trembling behind McWatt in the pilot seat. He looked desperately about for a gun, a gray-black .45 automatic that he could cock and ram right up against the base of McWatt's skull. There was no gun. There was no hunting knife either, and no other weapon with which he could bludgeon or stab, and Yossarian grasped and jerked the collar of McWatt's coveralls in tightening fists and shouted to him to go up, go up. The land was still swimming by underneath and flashing by overhead on both sides. McWatt looked back at Yossarian and laughed joyfully, as though Yossarian were sharing his fun. Yossarian slid both hands around McWatt's bare throat and squeezed. McWatt turned stiff.
"Go up!"
Yossarian ordered unmistakably through his teeth in a low, menacing voice.
"Or I'll kill you!"
Rigid with caution, McWatt cut the motors back and climbed gradually. Yossarian's hands weakened on McWatt's neck and slid down off his shoulders to dangle inertly. He was not angry anymore. He was ashamed. When McWatt turned, he was sorry the hands were his and wished there was some place where he could bury them. They felt dead. McWatt gazed at him deeply. There was no friendliness in his stare.
"Boy," he said coldly, "you sure must be in pretty bad shape. You ought to go home."
"They won't let me,"
Yossarian answered with averted eyes, and crept away. Yossarian stepped down from the flight deck and seated himself on the floor, hanging his head with guilt and remorse. He was covered with sweat. McWatt set course directly back toward the field. Yossarian wondered whether McWatt would now go to the operations tent to see Pilchard and Wren and request that Yossarian never be assigned to his plane again, just as Yossarian had gone surreptitiously to speak to them about Dobbs and Hoople and Orr, and unsuccessfully about Arfi. He had never seen McWatt look displeased before, had never seen him in any but the most lighthearted mood, and he wondered whether he had just lost another friend. But McWatt winked at him reassuringly as he climbed down from the plane and joshed hospitably with the credulous new pilot and bombardier during the jeep ride back to the squadron, although he did not address a word to Yossarian until all four had returned their parachutes and separated, and the two of them were walking side by side toward their own row of tents. Then McWatt's sparsely freckled, tan, Scotch-Irish face broke suddenly into a smile, and he dug his knuckles playfully into Yosarian's ribs as though throwing a punch.
"You louse," he laughed. "Were you really going to kill me up there?"
Yosarian grinned penitently and shook his head.
"No, I don't think so. I didn't realize you got it so bad. Boy, why don't you talk to somebody about it?"
"I talk to everybody about it. What the hell's the matter with you? Don't you ever hear me?"
"I guess I never really believed you."
"Aren't you ever afraid?"
"Maybe I ought to be.
Not even on the missions?"
"I guess I just don't have brains enough,"
McWatt laughed sheepishly.
"There are so many ways for me to get killed," Yosarian commented, "and you had to find one more."
McWatt smiled again.
"Say, I bet it really must scare you when I buzz your tent, huh?"
"It scares me to death. I've told you that."
"I thought it was just the noise you were complaining about."
McWatt made a resigned shrug.
"Oh, well, what the hell," he sang. "I guess I'll just have to give it up."
But McWatt was incorrigible, and while he never buzzed Yosarian's tent again, he never missed an opportunity to buzz the beach and roar like a fierce and low-flying thunderbolt over the raft in the water and the secluded hollow in the sand where Yosarian lay feeling up Nurse Duckett or playing hearts, poker, or pinochle with Nately, Dunbar, and Hungry Joe. Yosarian met Nurse Duckett almost every afternoon that both were free, and came with her to the beach on the other side of the narrow swell of shoulder-high dunes separating them from the area in which the other officers and enlisted men went swimming nude. Nately, Dunbar, and Hungry Joe would come there, too. McWatt would occasionally join them, and often Arfie, who always arrived pudgily in full uniform and never removed any of his clothing but his shoes and his hat. Arfie never went swimming. The other men wore swimming trunks in deference to Nurse Duckett, and in deference also to Nurse Kramer, who accompanied Nurse Duckett and Yosarian to the beach every time and sat haughtily by herself 10 yards away. No one but Arfie ever made reference to the naked men sunbathing in full view farther down the beach, or jumping and diving from the enormous whitewashed raft that bobbed on empty oil drums out beyond the silt sandbar. Nurse Kramer sat by herself because she was angry with Yosarian and disappointed in Nurse Duckett. Nurse Sue Ann Duckett despised Arfie, and that was another one of the numerous fetching traits about Nurse Duckett that Yosarian enjoyed. He enjoyed Nurse Sue Ann Duckett's long white legs and supple calipagus ass. He often neglected to remember that she was quite slim and fragile from the waist up, and hurt her unintentionally in moments of passion when he hugged her too roughly. He loved her manner of sleepy acquiescence when they lay on the beach at dusk. He drew solace and sedation from her nearness. He had a craving to touch her always, to remain always in physical communication. He liked to encircle her ankle loosely with his fingers as he played cards with Nately, Dunbar, and Hungry Joe, to lightly and lovingly caress the downy skin of her fair smooth thigh with the backs of his nails, or dreamily, sensuously, almost unconsciously slide his proprietary respectful hand up the shell-like ridge of her spine beneath the elastic strap of the top of the two-piece bathing suit she always wore to contain and cover her tiny, long-nippled breasts. He loved Nurse Duckett's serene, flattered response, the sense of attachment to him she displayed proudly. Hungry Joe had a craving to feel Nurse Duckett up, too, and was restrained more than once by Yosarian's forbidding glower. Nurse Duckett flirted with Hungry Joe, just to keep him in heat, and her round, light brown eyes glimmered with mischief every time Yosarian rapped her sharply with his elbow or fist to make her stop. The men played cards on a towel, undershirt, or blanket, and Nurse Duckett mixed the extra deck of cards, sitting with her back resting against a sand dune. When she was not shuffling the extra deck of cards, she sat squinting into a tiny pocket mirror, brushing mascara on her curling reddish eyelashes in a bird-brained effort to make them longer permanently. Occasionally she was able to stack the cards or spoil the deck in a way they did not discover until they were well into the game, and she laughed and glowed with blissful gratification when they all hurled their cards down disgustedly and began punching her sharply on the arms or legs as they called her filthy names and warned her to stop fooling around. She would prattle nonsensically when they were striving hardest to think, and a pink flush of elation crept into her cheeks when they gave her more sharp raps on the arms and legs with their fists and told her to shut up. Nurse Duckett reveled in such attention, and ducked her short chestnut bangs with joy when Yossarian and the others focused upon her. It gave her a peculiar feeling of warm and expectant well-being to know that so many naked boys and men were idling close by on the other side of the sand dunes. She had only to stretch her neck or rise on some pretext to see 20 or 40 undressed males lounging or playing ball in the sunlight. Her own body was such a familiar and unremarkable thing to her that she was puzzled by the convulsive ecstasy men could take from it, by the intense and amusing need they had merely to touch it, to reach out urgently and press it, squeeze it, pinch it, rub it. She did not understand Yossarian's lust, but she was willing to take his word for it. Evenings when Yossarian felt horny, he brought Nurse Duckett to the beach with 2 blankets, and enjoyed making love to her with most of their clothes on, more than he sometimes enjoyed making love to all the vigorous, bare, amoral girls in Rome. Frequently they went to the beach at night and did not make love, but just lay shivering between the blankets against each other to ward off the brisk, damp chill. The ink-black nights were turning cold, the stars frosty and fewer. The raft swayed in the ghostly trail of moonlight and seemed to be sailing away. A marked hint of cold weather penetrated the air. Other men were just starting to build stoves and came to Yossarian's tent during the day to marvel at Orr's workmanship. It thrilled Nurse Duckett rapturously that Yossarian could not keep his hands off her when they were together, although she would not let him slip them inside her bathing shorts during the day when anyone was near enough to see, not even when the only witness was Nurse Kramer, who sat on the other side of her sand dune with her reproving nose in the air and pretended not to see anything. Nurse Kramer had stopped speaking to Nurse Duckett, her best friend, because of her liaison with Yossarian, but still went everywhere with Nurse Duckett, since Nurse Duckett was her best friend. She did not approve of Yossarian or his friends. When they stood up and went swimming with Nurse Duckett, Nurse Kramer stood up and went swimming too, maintaining the same 10-yard distance between them, and maintaining her silence, snubbing them even in the water. When they laughed and splashed, she laughed and splashed. When they dived, she dived. When they swam to the sandbar and rested, Nurse Kramer swam to the sandbar and rested. When they came out, she came out, dried her shoulders with her own towel, and seated herself aloofly in her own spot, her back rigid, and a ring of reflected sunlight burnishing her light blonde hair like a halo. Nurse Kramer was prepared to begin talking to Nurse Duckett again, if she repented and apologized. Nurse Duckett preferred things the way they were. For a long time she had wanted to give Nurse Kramer a rap to make her shut up. Nurse Duckett found Yossarian wonderful, and was already trying to change him. She loved to watch him taking short naps with his face down and his arms thrown across her, or staring bleakly at the endless, tame, quiet waves, breaking like pet puppy dogs against the shore, scampering lightly up the sand a foot or two, and then trotting away. She was calm in his silences. She knew she did not bore him, and she buffed or painted her fingernails studiously while he dozed or brooded, and the desultory warm afternoon breeze vibrated delicately on the surface of the beach. She loved to look at his wide, long, sinewy back with its bronzed, unblemished skin. She loved to bring him to flame instantly by taking his whole ear in her mouth suddenly and running her hand down his front all the way. She loved to make him burn and suffer till dark, then satisfy him, then kiss him adoringly, because she had brought him such bliss. Yossarian was never lonely with Nurse Duckett, who really did know how to keep her mouth shut and was just capricious enough. He was haunted and tormented by the vast, boundless ocean. He wondered mournfully as Nurse Duckett buffed her nails about all the people who had died underwater. There were surely more than 1 million already. Where were they? What insects had eaten their flesh? He imagined the awful impotence of breathing in helplessly quarts and quarts of water. Yossarian followed the small fishing boats and military launches, plying back and forth far out, and found them unreal. It did not seem true that there were full-sized men aboard, going somewhere every time. He looked towards stony Elba, and his eyes automatically searched overhead for the fluffy white turnip-shaped cloud in which Clevenger had vanished. He peered at the vaporous Italian skyline and thought of Orr. Clevenger and Orr. Where had they gone? Yossarian had once stood on a jetty at dawn and watched a tufted round log that was drifting toward him on the tide turn unexpectedly into the bloated face of a drowned man. It was the first dead person he had ever seen. He thirsted for life and reached out ravenously to grasp and hold Nurse Duckett's flesh. He studied every floating object fearfully, for some gruesome sign of Clevenger and Orr, prepared for any morbid shock. But the shock McWatt gave him one day, with the plane that came blasting suddenly into sight out of the distant stillness, and hurtled mercilessly along the shoreline with a great, growling, clattering roar of the bobbing raft on which blond, pale Kid Sampson, his naked side scrawny even from so far away, leaped clownishly up to touch it at the exact moment some arbitrary gust of wind or minor miscalculation of McWatt's senses dropped the speeding plane down just low enough for a propeller to slice him half away. Even people who were not there remembered vividly exactly what happened next. There was the briefest, softest, filtering audibly through the shattering, overwhelming howl of the plane's engines. And then there were just Kid Samson's 2 pale, skinny legs, still joined by strings somehow at the bloody truncated hips, standing stock still on the raft for what seemed a full minute or two, before they toppled over backward into the water finally, with a faint echoing splash, and turned completely upside down, so that only the grotesque toes and the plaster-white soles of Kid Samson's feet remained in view. On the beach, all hell broke loose. Nurse Kramer materialized out of thin air suddenly and was weeping hysterically against Yossarian's chest while Yossarian hugged her shoulders and soothed her. His other arm bolstered Nurse Duckett, who was trembling and sobbing against him too, her long, angular face dead white. Everyone at the beach was screaming and running, and the men sounded like women. They scampered for their things in panic, stooping hurriedly and looking askance at each gentle knee-high wave bubbling in, as though some ugly red grisly organ like a liver or a lung might come washing right up against them. Those in the water were struggling to get out, forgetting in their haste to swim, wailing, walking, held back in their flight by the viscous, clinging sea as though by a biting wind. Kid Samson had reigned all over. Those who spied drops of him on their limbs or torsos drew back with terror and revulsion, as though trying to shrink away from their own odious skins. Everybody ran in a sluggish stampede, shooting tortured, horrified glances back, filling the deep, shadowy, rustling woods with their frail gasps and cries. Yossarian drove both stumbling, faltering women before him frantically, shoving them and prodding them to make them hurry, and raced back with a curse to help when Hungry Joe tripped on the blanket or the camera case he was carrying and fell forward on his face in the mud of the stream. Back at the squadron, everyone already knew. Men in uniform were screaming and running there, too, or standing motionless in one spot, rooted in awe, like Sergeant Knight and Dr. Nika, as they gravely craned their heads upward and watched the guilty, banking, forlorn airplane with McWatt circle and circle slowly and climb.
"Who is it?"
Yossarian shouted anxiously at Dr. Nika as he ran up, breathless and limp, his somber eyes burning with a misty, hectic anguish.
"Who's in the plane?"
"McWatt," said Sergeant Knight. "He's got the two new pilots with him on a training flight.
Dr. Nika's up there, too."
"I'm right here,"
contended Dr. Nika in a strange and troubled voice, darting an anxious look at Sergeant Knight.
"Why doesn't he come down?" Yossarian exclaimed in despair. "Why does he keep going up?"
"He's probably afraid to come down,"
Sergeant Knight answered without moving his solemn gaze from McWatt's solitary climbing airplane.
"He knows what kind of trouble he's in."
And McWatt kept climbing higher and higher, nosing his droning airplane upward evenly in a slow, oval spiral that carried him far out over the water, as he headed south and far in over the russet foothills when he had circled the landing field again and was flying north. He was soon up over 5,000 feet. His engines were soft as whispers. A white parachute popped open suddenly in a surprising puff. A second parachute popped open a few moments later and coasted down, like the first, directly in toward the clearing of the landing strip. There was no motion on the ground. The plane continued south for 30 seconds more, following the same pattern, familiar and predictable now, and McWatt lifted a wing and banked gracefully around into his turn.
"Two more to go," said Sergeant Knight. "McWatt and Dr. Nika." "I'm right here, Sergeant Knight," Dr. Nika told him plaintively. "I'm not in the plane."
"Why don't they jump?"
Sergeant Knight asked, pleading aloud to himself.
"Why don't they jump?"
"It doesn't make sense," grieved Dr. Nika, biting his lip. "It just doesn't make sense."
But Yossarian understood suddenly why McWatt wouldn't jump, and went running uncontrollably down the whole length of the squadron after McWatt's plane, waving his arms and shouting up at him imploringly to come down, McWatt, come down. But no one seemed to hear, certainly not McWatt, and a great choking moan tore from Yossarian's throat as McWatt turned again, dipped his wings once in salute, decided, "Oh, well, what the hell," and flew into a mountain. Colonel Cathcart was so upset by the deaths of Kid Sampson and McWatt that he raised the missions to 65. 31. Mrs. Danica. When Colonel Cathcart learned that Dr. Nika, too, had been killed in McWatt's plane, he increased the number of missions to 70. The first person in the squadron to find out that Dr. Nika was dead was Sergeant Towser, who had been informed earlier by the man in the control tower that Dr. Nika's name was down as a passenger on the pilot's manifest McWatt had filed before taking off. Sergeant Towser brushed away a tear and struck Dr. Nika's name from the roster of squadron personnel. With lips still quivering, he rose and trudged outside reluctantly to break the bad news to Gus and Wes. Discreetly avoiding any conversation with Dr. Nika himself, as he moved by the flight surgeon's slight sepulchral figure roosting despondently on his stool in the late afternoon sunlight between the orderly room and the medical tent, Sergeant Towser's heart was heavy. Now he had two dead men on his hands. Mud, the dead man in Yossarian's tent who wasn't even there, and Dr. Nika, the new dead man in the squadron, who most certainly was there, and gave every indication of proving a still thornier administrative problem for him. Gus and Wes listened to Sergeant Towser with looks of stoic surprise, and said not a word about their bereavement to anyone else until Dr. Nika himself came in about an hour afterward to have his temperature taken for the third time that day and his blood pressure checked. The thermometer registered a half degree lower than his usual subnormal temperature of 96.8. Dr. Nika was alarmed. The fixed, vacant wooden stares of his two enlisted men were even more irritating than always.
"God damn it!"
he expostulated politely in an uncommon excess of exasperation.
"What's the matter with you two men, anyway? It just isn't right for a person to have a low temperature all the time and walk around with a stuffed nose."
Dr. Nika emitted a glum, self-pitying sniff and strolled disconsolately across the tent to help himself to some aspirin and sulfur pills and paint his own throat with Argyrol. His downcast face was fragile and forlorn as a swallow's, and he rubbed the back of his arms rhythmically.
"Just look how cold I am right now. You sure you're not holding anything back?"
"You're dead, sir,"
one of his two enlisted men explained. Dr. Nika jerked his head up quickly with resentful distrust.
"What's that?"
"You're dead, sir," repeated the other. "That's probably the reason you always feel so cold."
"That's right, sir. You've probably been dead all this time. We just didn't detect it."
"What the hell are you both talking about?"
Dr. Nika cried shrilly, with a surging, petrifying sensation of some onrushing, unavoidable disaster.
"It's true, sir," said one of the enlisted men. "The records show that you went up in McWatt's plane to collect some flight time. You didn't come down on a parachute, so you must have been killed in a crash."
"That's right, sir," said the other. "You ought to be glad you got any temperature at all."
Dr. Nika's mind was reeling in confusion.
"Have you both gone crazy?" he demanded. "I'm going to report this whole insubordinate incident to Sergeant Towser."
"Sergeant Towser's the one that told us about it," said either Gus or Wes.
"The War Department's even going to notify your wife."
Dr. Nika yelped and ran out of the medical tent to remonstrate with Sergeant Towser, who edged away from him with repugnance, and advised Dr. Nika to remain out of sight as much as possible until some decision could be reached relating to the disposition of his remains.
"Gee, I guess he really is dead,"
grieved one of his enlisted men in a low, respectful voice.
"I'm going to miss him. He was a pretty wonderful guy, wasn't he?"
"Yeah, he sure was,"
mourned the other.
"But I'm glad the little fuck is gone. I was getting sick and tired of taking his blood pressure all the time."
Mrs. Danica, Dr. Nika's wife, was not glad that Dr. Nika was gone, and split the peaceful Staten Island night with woeful shrieks of lamentation when she learned by War Department telegram that her husband had been killed in action. Women came to comfort her, and their husbands paid condolence calls and hoped inwardly that she would soon move to another neighborhood and spare them the obligation of continuous sympathy. The poor woman was totally distraught for almost a full week. Slowly, heroically, she found the strength to contemplate a future filled with dire problems for herself and her children. Just as she was growing resigned to her loss, the postman rang with a bolt from the blue. A letter from overseas that was signed with her husband's signature and urged her frantically to disregard any bad news concerning him. Mrs. Danica was dumbfounded. The date on the letter was illegible. The handwriting throughout was shaky and hurried, but the style resembled her husband's, and the melancholy, self-pitying tone was familiar, although more dreary than usual. Mrs. Danica was overjoyed and wept irrepressibly with relief and kissed the crinkled, grubby tissue of female stationery 1,000 times. She dashed a grateful note off to her husband, pressing him for details, and sent a wire informing the War Department of its error. The War Department replied touchily that there had been no error, and that she was undoubtedly the victim of some sadistic and psychotic forger in her husband's squadron. The letter to her husband was returned unopened, stamped, "Killed in action." Mrs. Danica had been widowed cruelly again. But this time her grief was mitigated somewhat by a notification from Washington that she was sole beneficiary of her husband's $10,000 GI insurance policy, which amount was obtainable by her on demand. The realization that she and the children were not faced immediately with starvation brought a brave smile to her face and marked the turning point in her distress. The Veterans Administration informed her by mail the very next day that she would be entitled to pension benefits for the rest of her natural life because of her husband's demise, and to a burial allowance for him of $250. A government check for $250 was enclosed. Gradually, inexorably, her prospects brightened. A letter arrived that same week from the Social Security Administration stating that, under the provisions of the Old Age and Survivors Insurance Act of 1935, she would receive monthly support for herself and her dependent children until they reached the age of 18, and a burial allowance of $250. With these government letters as proof of death, she applied for payment on three life insurance policies Dr. Nika had carried, with a value of $50,000 each. Her claim was honored and processed swiftly. Each day brought new unexpected treasures. A key to a safe deposit box led to a fourth life insurance policy with a face value of $50,000 and to $18,000 in cash, on which income tax had never been paid and need never be paid. A fraternal lodge to which he had belonged gave her a cemetery plot. A second fraternal organization of which he had been a member sent her a burial allowance of $250. His county medical association gave her a burial allowance of $250. The husbands of her closest friends began to flirt with her. Mrs. Danica was simply delighted with the way things were turning out and had her hair dyed. Her fantastic wealth just kept piling up, and she had to remind herself daily that all the hundreds of thousands of dollars she was acquiring were not worth a single penny without her husband to share this good fortune with her. It astonished her that so many separate organizations were willing to do so much to bury Dr. Nika, who, back in Pianosa, was having a terrible time trying to keep his head above the ground, and wondered with dismal apprehension why his wife did not answer the letter he had written. He found himself ostracized in the squadron by men who cursed his memory foully for having supplied Colonel Cathcart with provocation to raise the number of combat missions. Records attesting to his death were pullulating like insect eggs and verifying each other beyond all contention. He drew no pay or PX rations and depended for life on the charity of Sergeant Towser and Milo, who both knew he was dead. Colonel Cathcart refused to see him, and Colonel Korn sent word through Major Danby that he would have Dr. Nika cremated on the spot if he ever showed up at Group headquarters. Major Danby confided that Group was incensed with all flight surgeons because of Dr. Stubbs. The bushy-haired, baggy-chinned, slovenly flight surgeon in Dunbar's squadron, who was deliberately and defiantly brewing insidious dissension there by grounding all men with 60 missions on proper forms that were rejected by Group indignantly, with orders restoring the confused pilots, navigators, bombardiers, and gunners to combat duty. Morale there was ebbing rapidly, and Dunbar was under surveillance. Group was glad Dr. Nika had been killed, and did not intend to ask for a replacement. Not even the chaplain could bring Dr. Nika back to life under the circumstances. Alarm changed to resignation, and more Dr. Nika acquired the look of an ailing rodent. The sacks under his eyes turned hollow and black, and he padded through the shadows fruitlessly like a ubiquitous spook. Even Captain Flume recoiled when Dr. Nika sought him out in the woods for help. Heartlessly, Gus and Wes turned him away from the medical tent without even a thermometer for comfort. And then, only then, did he realize that, to all intents and purposes, he really was dead, and that he had better do something damned fast if he ever hoped to save himself. There was nowhere else to turn but to his wife. And he scribbled an impassioned letter begging her to bring his plight to the attention of the War Department, and urging her to communicate at once with his group commander, Colonel Cathcart, for assurances that, no matter what else she might have heard, it was indeed he, her husband, Dr. Nika, who was pleading with her, and not a corpse or some impostor. Mrs. Danica was stunned by the depth of emotion in the almost illegible appeal. She was torn with compunction and tempted to comply. But the very next letter she opened that day was from the same Colonel Cathcart, her husband's group commander, and began, Dear Mrs., Mr., Miss., or Mr. and Mrs. Danica. Words cannot express the deep personal grief I experienced when your husband, son, father, or brother was killed, wounded, or reported missing in action. Mrs. Danica moved with her children to Lansing, Michigan, and left no forwarding address. 32. Yo-Yo's Roomies. Yossarian was warm when the cold weather came and whale-shaped clouds blew low through a dingy slate-gray sky, almost without end, like the droning dark iron flocks of B-17 and B-24 bombers from the long-range air bases in Italy the day of the invasion of southern France 2 months earlier. Everyone in the squadron knew that Kid Samson's skinny legs had washed up on the wet sand to lie there and rot like a purple twisted wishbone. No one would go to retrieve them, not Gus or Wes or even the men in the mortuary at the hospital. Everyone made believe that Kid Samson's legs were not there, that they had bobbed away south forever on the tide, like all of Clevenger and Orr. Now that bad weather had come, almost no one ever sneaked away alone anymore to peek through bushes like a pervert at the moldering stumps. There were no more beautiful days. There were no more easy missions. There was stinging rain and dull, chilling fog, and the men flew at week-long intervals whenever the weather cleared. At night, the wind moaned. The gnarled and stunted tree trunks creaked and groaned, and forced Yossarian's thoughts each morning, even before he was fully awake, back on Kid Samson's skinny legs, bloating and decaying, as systematically as a ticking clock in the icy rain and wet sand all through the blind, cold, gusty October nights. After Kid Samson's legs, he would think of pitiful, whimpering Snowden, freezing to death in the rear section of the plane, holding his eternal, immutable secret concealed inside his quilted armor-plate flak suit, until Yossarian had finished sterilizing and bandaging the wrong wound on his leg, and then spilling it out suddenly all over the floor. At night, when he was trying to sleep, Yossarian would call the roll of all the men, women, and children he had ever known who were now dead. He tried to remember all the soldiers, and he resurrected images of all the elderly people he had known when a child, all the aunts, uncles, neighbors, parents, and grandparents, his own and everyone else's, and all the pathetic, deluded shopkeepers who opened their small, dusty stores at dawn and worked in them foolishly until midnight. They were all dead, too. The number of dead people just seemed to increase, and the Germans were still fighting. Death was irreversible, he suspected, and he began to think he was going to lose. Yossarian was warm when the cold weather came because of Orr's marvelous stove, and he might have existed in his warm tent quite comfortably if not for the memory of Orr, and if not for the gang of animated roommates that came swarming inside rapaciously one day from the two full combat crews Colonel Cathcart had requisitioned and obtained in less than 48 hours as replacements for Kid Samson and McWatt. Yossarian emitted a long, loud, croaking gasp of protest when he trudged in tiredly after a mission and found them already there. There were four of them, and they were having a whale of a good time as they helped each other set up their cots. They were horsing around. The moment he saw them, Yossarian knew they were impossible. They were frisky, eager, and exuberant, and they'd all been friends in the States. They were plainly unthinkable. They were noisy, overconfident, empty-headed kids of 21. They had gone to college and were engaged to pretty, clean girls whose pictures were already standing on the rough cement mantelpiece of Orr's fireplace. They had ridden in speedboats and played tennis. They had been horseback riding. One had once been to bed with an older woman. They knew the same people in different parts of the country and had gone to school with each other's cousins. They had listened to the World Series and really cared who won football games. They were obtuse. Their morale was good. They were glad that the war had lasted long enough for them to find out what combat was really like. They were halfway through unpacking when Yossarian threw them out. They were plainly out of the question, Yossarian explained adamantly to Sergeant Towser, whose sallow equine face was despondent as he informed Yossarian that the new officers would have to be admitted. Sergeant Towser was not permitted to requisition another six-man tent from group while Yossarian was living in one alone.
"I'm not living in this one alone," Yossarian said with a sulk. "I got a dead man in here with me. His name is Mud."
"Please, sir," begged Sergeant Towser, sighing wearily, with a sidelong glance at the four baffled new officers listening in mystified silence just outside the entrance. "Mud was killed on the mission to Orvieto. You know that. He was flying right beside you.
Then why don't you move his things out?"
"Because he never even got here. Captain, please don't bring that up again. You can move in with Lieutenant Nately if you like. I'll even send some men from the orderly room to transfer your belongings." But to abandon Orr's tent would be to abandon Orr, who would have been spurned and humiliated clannishly by these four simple-minded officers waiting to move in. It did not seem just that these boisterous, immature young men should show up after all the work was done and be allowed to take possession of that most desirable tent on the island. But that was the law, Sergeant Towser explained, and all Yossarian could do was glare at them in baleful apology, as he made room for them and volunteer helpful, penitent hints as they moved inside his privacy and made themselves at home. They were the most depressing group of people Yossarian had ever been with. They were always in high spirits. They laughed at everything. They called him Yo-Yo jocularly and came in tipsy late at night and woke him up with their clumsy, bumping, giggling efforts to be quiet, then bombarded him with asinine shouts of hilarious good fellowship when he sat up cursing to complain. He wanted to massacre them each time they did. They reminded him of Donald Duck's nephews. They were afraid of Yossarian and persecuted him incessantly with nagging generosity and with their exasperating insistence on doing small favors for him. They were reckless, puerile, congenial, naive, presumptuous, deferential, and rambunctious. They were dumb. They had no complaints. They admired Colonel Cathcart, and they found Colonel Korn witty. They were afraid of Yossarian, but they were not the least bit afraid of Colonel Cathcart's 70 missions. There were four clean-cut kids who were having lots of fun, and they were driving Yossarian nuts. He could not make them understand that he was a crotchety old fogey of 28, that he belonged to another generation, another era, another world, that having a good time bored him and was not worth the effort, and that they bored him, too. He could not make them shut up. They were worse than women. They had not brains enough to be introverted and repressed. Cronies of theirs in other squadrons began dropping in unashamedly and using the tent as a hangout. There was often not enough room for him. Worst of all, he could no longer bring Nurse Duckett there to lie down with her. And now that foul weather had come, he had no place else. This was a calamity he had not foreseen, and he wanted to bust his roommates' heads open with his fists, or pick them up each in turn by the seats of their pants and the scruffs of their necks, and pitch them out once and for all into the dank, rubbery, perennial weeds growing between his rusty soup can urinal with nail holes in the bottom and the knotty pine squadron latrine that stood like a beach locker not far away. Instead of busting their heads open, he tramped in his galoshes and black raincoat through the drizzling darkness to invite Chief White Halfoat to move in with him, too, and drive the fastidious, clean-living bastards out with his threats and swinish habits. But Chief White Halfoat felt cold and was already making plans to move up into the hospital to die of pneumonia. Instinct told Chief White Halfoat it was almost time. His chest ached, and he coughed chronically. Whiskey no longer warmed him. Most damning of all, Captain Flume had moved back into his trailer. Here was an omen of unmistakable meaning.
We had to move back,
Yossarian argued in a vain effort to cheer up the glum, barrel-chested Indian, whose well-knit, sorrel-red face had degenerated rapidly into a dilapidated, calcareous gray.
He'd die of exposure if he tried to live in the woods in this weather.
No, that wouldn't drive the yellow belly back, Chief White Hafo disagreed obstinately.
He tapped his forehead with cryptic insight.
No, siree. He knows something. He knows it's time for me to die of pneumonia. That's what he knows. And that's how I know it's time.
What does Dr. Nika say? I'm not allowed to say anything,
Dr. Nika said sorrowfully from his seat on his stool in the shadows of a corner, his smooth, tapered, diminutive face turtle green in the flickering candlelight. Everything smelled of mildew. The bulb in the tent had blown out several days before, and neither of the two men had been able to muster the initiative to replace it.
I'm not allowed to practice medicine anymore, Dr. Nika added.
He's dead, Chief White Half-Oak gloated with a hoarse laugh entangled in phlegm. That's really funny.
I don't even draw my pay anymore.
That's really funny, Chief White Half-Oak repeated. All this time he's been insulting my liver, and look what happened to him. He's dead, killed by his own greed.
That's not what killed me,
Dr. Nika observed in a voice that was calm and flat.
There's nothing wrong with greed. It's all that lousy Dr. Stubbs' fault, getting Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Corn stirred up against flight surgeons. He's going to give the medical profession a bad name by standing up for principle. If he's not careful, he'll be blackballed by his state medical association and kept out of hospitals.
Yossarian watched Chief White Half-Oat pour whiskey carefully into three empty shampoo bottles and store them away in the musette bag he was packing.
Can't you stop by my tent on your way to the hospital and punch one of them in the nose for me?
He speculated aloud.
I got four of them. They're going to crowd me out of my tent altogether.
You know, something like that once happened to my whole tribe,
Chief White Half-Oat remarked in jolly appreciation, sitting back on his cot to chuckle.
Why don't you get Captain Black to kick those kids out? Captain Black likes to kick people out.
Yossarian grimaced sourly at the mere mention of Captain Black, who was already bullying the new flyers each time they stepped into his intelligence tent for maps or information. Yossarian's attitude towards his roommates turned merciful and protective at the mere recollection of Captain Black. It was not their fault that they were young and cheerful, he reminded himself as he carried the swinging beam of his flashlight back through the darkness. He wished that he could be young and cheerful, too. And it wasn't their fault that they were courageous, confident, and carefree. He would just have to be patient with them until one or two were killed and the rest wounded, and then they would all turn out okay. He vowed to be more tolerant and benevolent, but when he ducked inside his tent with his friendlier attitude, a great yellow blaze was roaring in the fireplace, and he gasped in horrified amazement.
Orr's beautiful birch logs were going up in smoke!
His roommates had set fire to them. He gaped at the four insensitive, overheated faces and wanted to shout curses at them. He wanted to bang their heads together as they greeted him with loud, convivial cries and invited him generously to pull up a chair and eat their chestnuts and roasted potatoes. What could he do with them? And the very next morning, they got rid of the dead man in his tent. Just like that. They whisked him away. They carried his cot and all his belongings right out into the bushes and simply dumped them there. And then they strode back, slapping their hands briskly at a job well done. Yossarian was stunned by their overbearing vigor and zeal, by their practical, direct efficiency. In a matter of moments, they had disposed energetically of a problem with which Yossarian and Sergeant Towser had been grappling unsuccessfully for months. Yossarian was alarmed. They might get rid of him just as quickly, he feared. And he ran to Hungry Joe and fled with him to Rome, the day before Nately's whore finally got a good night's sleep and woke up in love. 33. Nately's whore. He missed Nurse Duckett in Rome. There was not much else to do after Hungry Joe left on his mail run. Yossarian missed Nurse Duckett so much that he went searching hungrily through the streets for Luciana, whose laugh and invisible scar he had never forgotten, or the boozy, blousy, bleary-eyed floozy in the overloaded white brassiere and unbuttoned orange satin blouse, whose naughty salmon-colored cameo ring Arfie had thrown away so callously through the window of her car. How he yearned for both girls. He looked for them in vain. He was so deeply in love with them, and he knew he would never see either again. Despair gnawed at him. Visions beset him. He wanted Nurse Duckett with her dress up and her slim thighs bare to the hips. He banged a thin streetwalker with a wet cough who picked him up from an alleyway between hotels, but that was no fun at all. And he hastened to the enlisted men's apartment for the fat, friendly maid in the lime-colored panties, who was overjoyed to see him, but couldn't arouse him. He went to bed there early and slept alone. He woke up disappointed and banged a sassy, short, chubby girl he found in the apartment after breakfast, but that was only a little better, and he chased her away when he'd finished and went back to sleep. He napped till lunch, and then went shopping for presents for Nurse Duckett and a scarf for the maid in the lime-colored panties, who hugged him with such gargantuan gratitude that he was soon hot for Nurse Duckett and ran looking lecherously for Luciana again. Instead, he found Arfie, who had landed in Rome when Hungry Joe returned with Dunbar, Nately, and Dobbs, and who would not go along on the drunken foray that night to rescue Nately's whore from the middle-aged military big shots, holding her captive in a hotel because she would not say uncle.
"Why should I risk getting into trouble just to help her out?" Arfie demanded haughtily. "But don't tell Nately I said that. Tell him I had to keep an appointment with some very important fraternity brothers."
The middle-aged big shots would not let Nately's whore leave until they made her say uncle.
"Say uncle," they said to her.
"Uncle,"
she said.
"No, no, say uncle."
"Uncle,"
she said.
"She still doesn't understand."
"You still don't understand, do you? We can't really make you say uncle unless you don't want to say uncle, don't you see? Don't say uncle when I tell you to say uncle, okay? Say uncle."
"Uncle,"
she said.
"No, don't say uncle.
Say uncle."
She didn't say uncle.
"That's good. That's very good. It's a start. Now say uncle."
"Uncle,"
she said.
"It's no good. No, it's no good that way either. She just isn't impressed with us. It's just no fun making her say uncle when she doesn't care whether we make her say uncle or not. She really doesn't care, does she? Say foot.
Foot.
You see? She doesn't care about anything we do. She doesn't care about us. We don't mean a thing to you, do we?"
"Uncle,"
she said. She didn't care about them a bit, and it upset them terribly. They shook her roughly each time she yawned. She did not seem to care about anything, not even when they threatened to throw her out the window. They were utterly demoralized men of distinction. She was bored and indifferent, and wanted very much to sleep. She had been on the job for 22 hours, and she was sorry these men had not permitted her to leave with the other two girls with whom the orgy had begun. She wondered vaguely why they wanted her to laugh when they laughed, and why they wanted her to enjoy it when they made love to her. It was all very mysterious to her, and very uninteresting. She was not sure what they wanted from her. Each time she slumped over with her eyes closed, they shook her awake and made her say uncle again. Each time she said uncle, they were disappointed. She wondered what uncle meant. She sat on the sofa in a passive, phlegmatic stupor, her mouth open and all her clothing crumpled in a corner on the floor, and wondered how much longer they would sit around naked with her and make her say uncle in the elegant hotel suite to which Orr's old girlfriend, giggling uncontrollably at Yossarian's and Dunbar's drunken antics, guided Nately and the other members of the motley rescue party. Dunbar squeezed Orr's old girlfriend's fanny gratefully and passed her back to Yossarian, who propped her against the door jamb with both hands on her hips and wormed himself against her lasciviously until Nately seized him by the arm and pulled him away from her into the blue sitting room, where Dunbar was already hurling everything in sight out the window into the court. Dobbs was smashing furniture with an ashstand. A nude, ridiculous man with a blushing appendectomy scar appeared in the doorway suddenly and bellowed,
"What's going on here?"
"Your toes are dirty," Dunbar said. The man covered his groin with both hands and shrank from view. Dunbar, Dobbs, and Hungry Joe just kept dumping everything they could lift out the